Hey, it's Chuck Armstrong with Loudwire Nights, and this is Loudwire Nights on Demand. We got to hang with Kim Thiel from Soundgarden, celebrating his new memoir, A Screaming Life. This interview aired on Friday, June 5th. Here we go. Well, tonight we are diving into the legacy of one of the greatest bands of the last several decades, a band that we love here on the show and a band we celebrate every chance we get. And tonight, that celebration is centered around the new memoir, A Screaming Life Into the Super Unknown with Soundgarden and Beyond, written by co-founder and guitarist of Soundgarden, Kim Thiel. Kim, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, you know, listen, right out of the gate, how's it feel to have this memoir finished and, you know, people are starting to read it?
Well, it ended up being a lot more work for me toward the end. During the beginning, most of the interviews were conducted by Adam Tepetlden. And so he was doing a lot of, you know, we had someone else doing transcriptions who passed away. Don Anderson / Jack Endino. And then Adam was working on a lot of the transcriptions. And I thank him very much for enduring that, because he had to go through hours of, you know, taped interviews and phone calls. Yeah. Where I tend to jump around and digress like I play my guitar solos. And he had to try to decipher all that. So that was probably a lot of work for him to try to, you know, decipher and organize all that. And then after that, I became more involved in revisions. And a couple weeks ago, I did the audiobook. Man, that was something.
Oh,
I don't know if I spent that much time in the studio with an open mic going on for hours.
Yeah. That I imagine that gets a little overwhelming at times, just reading this over and over. It was,
but it was satisfying. We had a great director, and we managed to come up with a really, you know, constructive pace.
So. That's great, man. Well, you know, I'm curious. And we, you know, we talked to a lot of musicians on the show, and a lot of musicians are writing memoirs now. And I've heard from more than one that they think it's a lot harder to create a book than it is to create an album. Can you relate to that, or what do you?
Yeah,
think?
I think for someone who's used to creating albums, it's a lot harder to create a book. I imagine if you're an author and then decided to like get your buddies together, form a band, and make an album, you might learn the other thing, you know?
Yeah.
But there is, I think, you know, books are often a solitary affair, you know. Fortunately, Adam Tepetlden, you know, co-author, did a lot of the organizing, because if I had to organize it again, it would just read like my guitar solos. Inscrutable.
Well, you know, you cover so much ground in the book too, man. And, you know, it sounds like you and Adam had hours and hours of conversations that you know, led to the things that we read in the memoir. Were you ever concerned or worried about sharing some of the things that are in the book?
Sure. There are a lot of things in the book that were covered over the decades in interviews, either radio or TV, maybe a bit here, maybe a bit there. And sometimes there are anecdotes that are described that aren't really followed up on with subsequent interviewers or interviews. So they're just kind of out there, you know, with one particular radio or TV thing. But in the book, it is, you know, it's going to be definitely more permanent and fixed with my face on the cover. So I can't pull a Charles Barkley and say that I was misquoted in my own autobiography.
Well, no, that's true, man. You've done, you know, interviews for decades, and so this is, you know, a chance to sort of, you know, I guess kind of set the record straight, right? You get to take ownership of the story and say, no, this is the story. This is what happened.
Yeah. I mean, for the most part, it's definitely my perspective, and you know, your one's knowledge and perspective of oneself and their relationships is dynamic. It's always changing. I have a different understanding of my relationship with my parents as an adult, as an, you know, older adult than as a kid or as a college student. And you have different understandings of your romantic partnerships, your close friends, your coworkers, and your creative partnerships. So it is dynamic. So what there could be things in there that I said 3 years ago that maybe I have a different perspective on, you know, because relationships are dynamic and one's insight into them and oneself is always changing as well. But there was an opportunity for me to discuss things that usually rock journalists aren't interested in, you know, like my childhood, family, things I thought were, you know, influential to me that were not necessarily about music. Obviously, the publishers were very interested in the music story, and in particular, the Soundgarden story. So as much as I might try to steer it away to things that I thought were formative and impactful in my life, they want to steer it back to what they think the readers would want to know. And what the readers want to know and what I want to tell are often two different things. So,
what prompted you to do this? You know, what was sort of the point where
really
you were
like, discussions with Adam over, you know, I mean, I'd always entertained my, you know, being a fiction writer. You know, I'm sure many of you out there have, you know, since I was younger. And I thought at some point that I would write something that was a little bit more, as you get older, and then I majored in philosophy. So the idea of fiction, which might have some context allegorically or metaphorically, and or aphoristically. And I decided that maybe fiction was not where my interest was going as I got older. And I thought it'd be interesting to kind of either fictionalize my story or to collect anecdotes about my story and my life and my experiences with friends. I have some really brilliant and strange friends throughout my life. I mean, smart people, funny people, people with a different take on life and the world and ideas. And a lot, I remember so many of these, and I would love to share them and compile them. And I think that interest had been there, and I thought, man, do I want my parents to read that? Who do I want to read that? Do I just want to tell it and not have anyone read it? So really, it was always there. And then Adam, you know, proposed, well, why don't we do a book? And I balked at first, and then the pandemic happened, so it put some stuff on hold. But the conversations continued, and it became more and more interesting. Again, there's always a difference between what publishers know about you and what they want conveyed to the consuming audience, and then there's what I know about me and what I want conveyed. So there's always going to be a little bit of that tug push.
Yeah. Well, and like you said, you know, hours and hours of conversations with Adam, and, you know, clearly just stories upon stories that didn't make the cut for the book. Now that you've got a book under your belt, now maybe the door's open. You can tell some of those stories in a
yes, sir. I would definitely love to do that. Definitely.
I love that, man. Well, one of the things I loved reading in this book, and it came up a couple, you know, several different times, was just how you would learn other artists or bands were fans of your music, of Soundgarden. And one of the things that stood out to me was how you heard James Hetfield from Metallica would carry around a cassette of Ultra Mega OK with him.
Yeah, I heard that from, you know, people in the music business. Like, we were friends of the guys from Faith No More, so I might have heard that from some of the guys in Faith No More, but I also heard that from people like at various record labels, you know. And they had mentioned that this was back in the 80s. They mentioned he was a fan of Ultra Mega OK and that he had kept the cassette with them. It was turning people onto it. That was amazing. At that time, remember, this is before Injustice for All. So Metallica was, you know, Kill 'Em All and Master of Puppets. And we had had, you know, we had two records out ourselves and some U.S. tours and one European tour under our belt, but not the kind of workhorses that Metallica had been for years. So we knew there, you know, we were very aware of their, you know, their career and artistic trajectory. And it was, you know, although we were very much involved with our peers here in Seattle, because there's so much going on, and then some similar minded folks across the country and et cetera. But, you know, bands like Metallica and Slayer and Anthrax were definitely on our radar, as well as, you know, bands from other genres. I mean, the Beastie Boys were way on our radar before, you know, License to Ill, you know, the Cookie Puss EP and stuff. So, So we were aware of what was going on with other bands that we liked, that we enjoyed. You know? It was incredibly flattering. Yeah.
We recently had Pepper Keenan and Woody Weatherman on the show.
Yes.
Talking about the new COC album. And man, you know, we would just get into a little bit of, you know, music you like and you know, the grunge era and all that. And just both of them so quick to say, oh, Soundgarden, they were it for us, man.
We had some amazing tours with them. Back then, Pepper and Woody were the two guitars, and back then they had Phil singing, Carl singing, and Phil on bass. Did I have that right? So they were a five-piece then. Of course, Reed, Pepper, Woody, Phil, but we called him Canyon Man. He was on bass. Yeah, and Carl was singing.
Yeah.
And then we toured with them. Gosh. Yeah, we got a history of them. They're great.
I love that. And you mentioned Faith No More, and you talk about there's a little story in the book too about sitting on a tour bus, and it was the guys from Metallica, the guys from Faith No More, and Buzz from the Melvins all just hanging out. And you called it surreal, but not in a starstruck sort of way.
Buzz called it surreal, not me.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
We were sitting there, and Buzz like looks around, and he looks at me, he goes, "Holy shit." I'm sitting here next to James. I'm sitting with James Hetfield and Kim Thayil and Billy Gould and you know, Jim Martin. I can't remember who all were there. And he thought it's surreal. And I looked at him and said, "Ed Buzz from the Melvins."
That's right, man. Yeah. I mean, you know, you think about those moments, right? People telling you that James Hetfield, you know, is carrying a tape around it to introduce people to Soundgarden or the moment like that on the tour bus. And there's so many moments like that. Did you, like, in the moment, did you feel like, wow, like pinch me? Or what was going through your head?
Totally. We were all stoked. I mean, but we were doing the same thing. You know, people ask, what are you listening to? We bring them out to the van. You know, we like cassette player in the van. It's like, I tell you, it was on our heavy rotation in our U.S. tours in around 88, 89. It was Nirvana, Bleach. It was the first Fugazi EP. I believe that's Margin Walker. I think Neil Young, Harvest or After the Gold Rush, one of those two. The Monks of Doom, the Cosmo Demonic Telegraph. Is that it? The Cosmo Demonic Telegraph Factory? That's a mouthful, that title, so I hope I got it right. So, I mean, it's all the time. We listen to the Fugazi EP, and it's like, what do you want to hear next? It's like, play that again. It's like, yeah.
What was it about Fugazi that you hooked with, man?
Oh, amazing, amazing guitar sounds. I mean, everything. It just sounded great, but also the arrangements they have, the songs, it was... It felt live and just kind of jumped at you, you know, and they had very creative and, you know, approaches to guitar, which was something we appreciated because that was something that we thought we were doing. We were doing what they did, but similarities, you know, harmonics and feedback and stuff. But it was just sonically so, so cool. And it was at a point in time where we were a little bit disappointed with the production on Ultra Mega OK. We thought these songs were just amazing. We thought sonically it was kind of lacking the punch that we thought we had live. And then you hear the Fugazi records, like, man, these guys, they sound like they imagine they are live. We never had the opportunity to see them live because whenever they were in Seattle, we were in DC on tour or vice versa. Yeah. Our friends would call us, you know, or write us, you know, say, "Saw Fugazi last week, man, they're amazing. You should have been here." You know.
Yeah,
it's the same deal. When you know, I'm Faith No More is the same way, man. Mike Borden brought us onto their tour bus, said, "Hey, there's this band you guys got to hear. You're going to love them." And he pops in Caius, you know, and it was at that time, it was just like a demo cassette. He was like blasting Caius. He goes, "I know you guys are going to love this." So that stuff was always happening, you know, and thank God for touring bands, you know, turning other bands onto, you know, what's going on in their town or on their playlist.
Well, and I got to imagine, man, you know, you were a teenager loving music, right? Like you were a big MC5 fan. And so to then become a touring musician.
Kiss fan, I'll admit it.
That's all right. You can admit it, man. But to, you know, to be this touring musician now, this recording musician, this rock star, and, you know, living your dream, but then to still be surrounded by just fans and you're all sharing sharing your love of music. Like, that had to be so cool.
Yeah, definitely. Exactly. I mean, you're connecting. You're young enough where that kind of, I don't want to use the word networking because that sounds business. The social connecting with like-minded people. Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, when I'm 15 and I'm the only one in my high school who seems to like Kiss, you know, and then when I'm 17, I'm apparently the only one in my high school who likes the Sex Pistols or the Ramones, or the only one who likes, you know, the MC5 or the Stooges. Don't invite Kim over. He's going to bring his stupid punk rock record. You know, whether it was, you know, Kiss and Aerosmith, you know, in my younger ages to, you know, the punk rock stuff I was listening to later, my other friends just didn't like that. They were, I mean, well, it's the 70s, you know, so you got some dudes who are into the Grateful Dead and Utopia.
Yeah.
And then you got people who are into Roxy Music and Bowie, which I was. There's some crossover, you know, Bowie definitely connects. And then you have people who are into like Zappa and people who are into like prog, you know, so they're always listening to Yes and Genesis and Pink Floyd, a lot of prog people. And so we kind of meet at Rush, you know, or something.
Yeah.
And I had a few geeky jazz buddies. And I mean, they were into like, the cool thing was they were into like, you know, Ornette Coleman, Albert Ayler, Eric Dolphy, Sun Ra. And so then we meet kind of at Beefheart, you know, or the Contortions or something, you know. And so there was some crossover, but basically I was used to discovering things for myself and not liking them in any social context. Because in spite of the fact that I had some friends who were into music, they didn't like my music. So it was me. And I'll connect this in a second. So it's me and my record collection. I mean, I'm foregoing school lunch for 2 weeks so I can save up $5 and then go and buy the used copy of the Stooges Funhouse that I found at the record swap.
Yeah.
And then play it at home when my parents weren't around, or take it to your friend's house where they won't play it. They'll put on, you know, Zappa or something. I liked Zappa. I love Hot Rats. I love Freak Out. I found a copy of Freak Out at Wax Trax in Chicago when I was like 19. I found a copy there for $2. I was like, yes.
Oh, man.
And the guy goes, this must be mislabeled. That probably should be 20. And he looked at me and he goes, oh, well, that's what it's, that's how it's labeled.
Nice score.
So, connecting with Chris and Hero and realizing that our tastes start out, this is a slightly different place. They all kind of connect, you know, with people like the Big Boys and Minutemen and, mm-hmm. Meat Puppets and Wire and Killing Joke. So that's a big deal. And then you're making music with these people who have some interest in your record collection. And then you go on tour and you start connecting with this community. So yeah, that's important to that kid who drew pictures of Ace Frehley and had other people, you know, ridicule you for that. It's, you know, believe me, they're all contrite and they all apologize for criticizing the Sex Pistols and the Clash.
For
now,
sure. So. Oh, yeah. They've learned. Yes.
Yeah. But meeting those people all over the world and realizing, wow, there's a community and these people are writing songs and they're starting their own bands and they like our band. They like what we're doing. Yeah, that's super cool. It's rewarding, especially when you're young and what you're doing is kind of part of your identity. You kind of wear these things like a badge. You know, this is my band. This is what I'm into. These are the bands I like, you know.
You know, in the book, you talk a little bit about how you kind of felt like Soundgarden was different from other bands. And not you know, musically necessarily, but how you guys never chased sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You were always making sure you were respectful to each other, to fans, to the crew, to everyone. Was that a conscious decision you guys made early on in the life of the band?
I think it was the kind of people we were. Now, we would fail at that because we're people and we're young, but that's the kind of people we were, and we recognized that. And so we would sort of be gatekeepers. We'd remind each other that this is who we are. This is where we come from. And I think if people, if any of us individually were to behave in a way that was somewhat out of character, the other three or even including the guys in the crew would remind us of that fact. And they'd say, hey, that was kind of dickish what you said to that person or how you acted. And you'll think about it. Oh, God, you're right. And if you can, and you can find them, you can go and apologize or whatever. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening and stupid behavior sneaks in there all the time.
Well, and part of that respect and that learning, right, like figuring this out, was about how you guys wrote together and, you know, some things were accepted, some things were rejected. And, you know, you talk about not immediately being a fan of Black Hole Sun as a Soundgarden song. You liked it, but you didn't, you know, you weren't necessarily convinced it was a Soundgarden song. Obviously, eventually you embraced it. What was that turning point for you with that song?
Well, it was apparent from the get-go that it was a great song, that just the way it was crafted, it was put together brilliantly and it was memorable and hooky. But, and, you know, I'd always have to sort of navigate if Chris did a demo. Sometimes he'd bring a song in and show it on guitar. Sometimes he'd demo it thinking that would be a stronger way to present it. You know, it's like, if I play this on guitar, they might not get where it's coming from. Or I can't sing this and play it on guitar, so I'll just record it and show it to these guys. His demos tended to be kind of bright and thin, you know, in those early days. That's kind of the way he heard things. He was a drummer, so, you know, maybe it's a snare thing but, you know, I suppose if you're banging on a hi-hat and a crash cymbal and a snare for much of your life, you're probably losing some of that high end. So you're probably maybe missing. And so I'd hear that. It's like, you know, I think of us as heavy and big, you know, or at least in terms of the guitar and bass sounds, even if the song isn't necessarily a heavy song. And so you hear Black Hole Sun and it's the opposite. It's the right hand side of the piano. It's a bunch of, you know, it's Tinkerbell, you know, ding, 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 these arpeggios. And I wrote a lot of arpeggios. Most of our early, I believe I was the one who introduced that since I was a guitarist. So when I'm writing songs, I'm often writing riffs on arpeggios, which I thought was cool. But this is different. It wasn't just like the low end of the guitar neck, you know, doing some triplets or whatever, some little arpeggiated things that are kind of weird. It was just delicate, dainty thing. And I thought, oh man. So when I first heard it, great song. Is it going to work with, I'm trying to remember when Chris first presented the demo. It was definitely before we were recording. It was definitely, I think it was before Super Unknown. But I have some memory of giving it context with what we had just done with Bad Motorfinger. So if you listen to Bad Motorfinger, it's like, how do I squeeze how would Black Hole Sun fit with that?
Yeah,
but there was never a doubt that we would probably be on the album. So I didn't hear it as a Soundgarden song at first. I thought, but I'm going to have to learn it and turn it into a Soundgarden song. I'm going to have to guitar brand it in a way that has it to the best that I can to make it work. Because I could kind of see that everyone had the same, you know, initial reaction was that, oh, man, that's a great song. Yeah. And that's like, how do we make it fit?
That's it, man. All right. I got a couple last questions. And I got to ask. So I was at Back to the Beginning last year, the Ozzy and Sabbath show. And I know Soundgarden was initially announced that they're going to be part of it. And I, you know, I'm convinced it would have been a really powerful presence at the show. Yeah. Was it as simple as a scheduling difficulties for you guys to not be able to make it?
Yeah, I think it might have been prematurely announced because we were still trying to work things out. Obviously, we're trying to coordinate things with a singer and coordinate things with our schedule. At that time, I think Matt was doing Pearl Jam tours and he had some time off, you know, so he's already in that touring mode. So for him, it's like,
let's go.
I'm in this mode. Let's go there and we'll go do this. And he really wanted to do it. It's like, well, I'm in studio mode. So it means you have to shut everything down and ship gear over there, you know, or rent gear. But my guitars, we're going to have to ship it over there, ship Ben's bass over there. So we're going to have to like, and I think the crew guys, you know, one of our engineers also works our live touring. He said, you're really changing momentum. We got to pack up all this stuff and, you know, and the stuff we're doing for the record and kind of ship stuff over there. And the manager thought, we can make it work. We can make it work, but there's a lot of hoops we got to jump through. And then the person we thought about singing would you know, we had talked to Taylor, but her band was on tour and they were in Europe. We thought, well, is that a good thing? Because she's already over there.
Right, yeah.
And
with ACDC,
and
we
looked at the schedules and her dates, and she had to jump through some hoops, and it was really expensive. We're not getting paid for this, you know, so we would get paid for our costs, you know, travel, hotel. And, you know, it was brought to our attention that, you know, I think we crew, hotel, all that. It's like, and we said, you know, at some point, this won't be worth it for those guys, the promoters, because they got to fly you guys in. They got to try to fly in a potential singer for, and if it's Taylor, she's over there, and she's gonna, and you know, it's not going to be a commercial flight that's scheduled. You're probably going to get this private flight, fly her here and fly her back, and then you got to go there, and then you got to come back, and you got to bring the crew over, and you got, and who knows which of your crew guys are available. And it all just seemed like a scheduling nightmare to you know, go there for what, like maybe 5 days or a week and play seven minutes. And then play it like one in the afternoon. And it just seemed again, Matt's doing Pearl Jam, I'm doing studio stuff and working on the book and dealing with other, personal, you know, family stuff. And Ben's in the same situation, and Taylor's on tour with AC/DC. So it's and when it came down to it, all the hoops were jumpable. It was really a hassle, and it was jumpable, but it was like, and we thought, okay, let's just orient ourselves towards the recording and the studio and as much as we'd all like to do this, we should probably, not. We knew there might not be another opportunity, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a tough one. And I think Matt was the most disappointed, but again, he already had that momentum. He was already in tour. The rest of us are sitting around. Peek, peek, peek.
So
the microphones on us.
You're talking about being in the studio in the last question, but, and you talk about this a bit in the book, but you know, the final album from Soundgarden, what's on the horizon for this?
We're still, it is not a traditional recording process, obviously, where the record label budgets time and money for you and says, okay, here's the month and a half or whatever it takes to like record the record and work out whatever, write, add, subtract, whatever you need to do, and then go mix. It's kind of like backward and sideways and requires some forensics, you know, where you're listening to stuff like, what do we need here? What is working? What isn't? What do we need to redo? A lot of guitars had to be done. A lot of bass had to be done. Some drums, you know. So it's still at that, you know. And there's all these other things that we're doing as individuals as well. So we'll keep at it.
Fair enough, man. Kim Thiel, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough for hanging tonight. Congrats on this memoir, Screaming Life. And I can't stress it enough to everyone listening. This is a memoir you do not want to miss. We just scratched the surface in this conversation, but the book goes deep, and I think it's going to be celebrated as a must-read by music fans universally. You can get details at soundgardenworld.com. We'll keep you posted here too, of course. But Kim, man, if the opportunity ever comes up again, please know it's an open door here, and you are welcome back anytime.
Oh, by the way, our people often bring up that you're you share names with a famous Seahawks head coach, Seattle Seahawks.
Yes, and actually, I have gotten emails every once in a while.
Addressed to him.
Yes. Every once in a while, yeah. So it has been brought up. there's the Seattle connection, Kim.
Yeah,
thank
exactly.
Thank you so much for the time, man. I hope we can do this again soon.
Oh, definitely. Thanks, Chuck.
That wraps up this episode of Loudwire Nights on Demand. Stay caught up with everything happening in the world of rock and metal on the Loudwire app and at loudwire.com.